Features of the Lamrim Teachings. Atisha's Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment. In terms of the lineage of the teachings of the two texts we will be following here, I first received the transmission of Lama Tsongkhapa's text Lines of Experience from Tathag Rinpoche at a very early age, and later from my most venerable tutors, the late Kyabje Ling Rinpoche, who was also the master for my full ordination as a monk, and the late Kyabje Trijang Rinpoche. The transmission of Atisha's text, A Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment, was quite hard to find at one point, but I received it from my late teacher Rigzin Tempa, who may have received the lineage from Kangsar Dorje Chang. Later, I received a teaching on it from the late Sirkong Tsenshab Rinpoche, who gave the transmission in conjunction with Panchen Losang Churgyen's commentary, which he was able to present almost exclusively by heart. Lamp for the Path, Verse 1. Homage to the Bodhisattva, the youthful Manjushri. I pay homage with great respect to the conquerors of the three times, to their teaching, and to those who aspire to virtue. Urged by the good disciple Zhangjub Er, I shall illuminate the lamp for the path to enlightenment. The line, Homage to the Bodhisattva, the youthful Manjushri, is a salutation written by the translator who originally translated this text from Sanskrit into Tibetan. At the end of the first verse, the author states his intention for composing this text. A Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment was composed in Tibet by the Indian master Atisha Dipamkara Srijana. During the reign of the Nari kings, Lalama Yeshe U and his nephew Changchub U, tremendous efforts were made to invite Atisha from India to Tibet. As a result of these efforts, Lalama Yeshe U was imprisoned by a neighboring anti-Buddhist king and actually lost his life, but Changchub U persevered and was finally successful. When Atisha arrived in Tibet, Changchub U requested him to give a teaching that would be beneficial to the entire Tibetan population. In response, therefore, Atisha wrote A Lamp for the Path, which makes it a unique text because, although it was written by an Indian master, it was composed in Tibet specifically for Tibetans. The meaning of the title. The title, A Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment, has profound meaning. The Tibetan term for enlightenment is Changchub, the two syllables of which refer to the two aspects of the Buddha's enlightened qualities. Chang connotes the enlightened quality of having overcome all obstructions, negativities, and limitations. Chub literally means embodiment of all knowledge, and connotes the quality of Buddha's realization and wisdom. Therefore, Changchub means the Buddha's enlightened quality of having abandoned and overcome all negativities and limitations, purity, combined with the perfection of all knowledge, realization. Changchub Chenpo, great enlightenment, is an epithet for the Buddha's enlightened state. The title, A Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment, suggests that this text presents the method or process by which we can actualize the state of enlightenment. When we speak about enlightenment and the path leading to it, we are naturally speaking about a quality or a state of mind. In the final analysis, enlightenment is nothing other than a perfected state of mind. Enlightenment should not be understood as some kind of physical location or rank or status that is conferred upon us. It is the state of mind where all negativities and limitations have been purified, and all potentials of positive qualities fully perfected and realized. Since the ultimate objective is the state of mind, the methods and paths by which it is attained must also be states of mind. Enlightenment cannot be attained by external means, only through an internal process. As we develop and improve our states of mind, our knowledge, wisdom, and realization gradually increase, culminating in our attainment of enlightenment. The metaphor of the lamp is used because, just as a lamp dispels darkness, the teachings in this text dispel the darkness of misunderstanding with respect to the path to enlightenment. Just as a lamp illuminates whatever objects lie in its sphere, this text shines a light on all the various elements and subtle points of the path leading to full enlightenment. The Objects of Salutation. The objects of salutation in this verse, the conquerors of the three times, are the three jewels of refuge. It is important to pay homage to the Buddha, not as just some noble object, but in terms of the meaning of Changchub. The Sanskrit term for Changchub is Bodhi, which conveys a sense of awakening, a state where all knowledge and realization have been perfected. Therefore, when explaining the meaning of awakening or enlightenment, we can speak about both the process by which this awakening takes place and the state to which awakening brings us. In other words, the means and the fruition. When we understand enlightenment as a resultant state, we are primarily referring to the enlightened quality of purity, the perfected state where all negativities and limitations have been purified. There is another aspect to this purity, which is the primordially pure nature of the enlightened state. The reason why enlightenment is a perfected state where all obscurations have been purified is because natural purity is its fundamental basis. When we understand enlightenment as a process or an instrument by which awakening is experienced, we are referring to the Buddha's enlightened quality of wisdom. This is the Dharmakaya, the Buddha body of reality, the wisdom body, or wisdom embodiment, of the Buddha, and it is this wisdom that brings about the perfection and purification. Thus, we can understand the significance of the explanations of the different types of nirvana in the scriptures. For example, we speak of natural nirvana, nirvana with residue, nirvana without residue, and non-abiding nirvana. Natural nirvana refers to the fundamentally pure nature of reality, where all things and events are devoid of any inherent, intrinsic, or independent reality. This is the fundamental ground. It is our misconception of this fundamental reality that gives rise to all the delusions and their derivative thoughts and emotions. No matter how powerful the false perceptions of reality may be at any given time, if we subject them to scrutiny, we will find that they have no grounding in reason or experience. On the other hand, the more we cultivate the correct understanding of emptiness as the nature of reality and relate this understanding to actual reality, the more we will be able to affirm and develop it, because it is a correct way of perceiving the world. Flawed perceptions lack grounding, experience, and reasoning, whereas grounding, experience, and reasoning support the understanding of emptiness. Thus, we will come to understand that this highest antidote, the wisdom of emptiness, can be developed and enhanced to its fullest potential. This is the understanding of natural nirvana, which makes possible the attainment of the other nirvanas. What is this natural nirvana that serves as the basis for attaining such purity and perfection? On what grounds do we know that such an ultimate nature of reality exists? We can answer these questions from everyday experience. We are all aware of the fundamental fact that there is often a gap between the way we perceive things and the way things really are. This disparity between our perception of reality and the actual state of affairs leads to all kinds of problems and confusion. However, we also know that our perception sometimes does correspond to reality accurately. If we go further, we will see that there are two levels of reality. At one level, that of conventional or relative reality, worldly conventions operate, and our perception and understanding of things and events is based purely upon the way that things appear to us. However, when we question the ultimate status of things and events and the way that they really exist, we enter another realm or level, that of ultimate reality. The Two Truths. Buddhism discusses what are known as the two truths, the truths of conventional and ultimate reality. The concept of two levels of reality is not unique to Buddhism. It is a common epistemological approach in many of the ancient Indian schools. Followers of the non-Buddhist Samkhya school, for example, explain reality in terms of 25 categories of phenomena. The self, Sanskrit Purusha, Tibetan Kyebu, and the primal substance, Sanskrit Prakriti, Tibetan Rangjin, are said to be ultimate truths, while the remaining 23 categories of phenomenon are said to be manifestations or expressions of this underlying reality. However, what is unique in Mahayana, particularly in the Madhyamaka or middle way school, is that conventional and ultimate truths are not seen as two unrelated independent entities, but as different perspectives of one and the same world. According to the middle way school of Buddhism, the ultimate truth, or the ultimate nature of reality, is the emptiness of all things and events. In trying to understand the meaning of this emptiness, we can turn to the teachings of the Indian master, Nagarjuna, who brought together all the various understandings of emptiness into the single statement that emptiness must be understood in terms of dependent origination. When we talk about emptiness, what we are negating or denying is the possibility of things or events having inherent existence. This suggests that all things and events come into being purely as a result of the gathering of causes and conditions, regardless of how complex the nexus of these causes and conditions may be. It is within this nexus of causes and conditions that we can understand the complexity and multiplicity of the world of experience. There is great diversity in the everyday world of experience, including our own immediately relevant experiences of pain and pleasure. Even pain and pleasure are not independently existent real experiences. They also come into being as a result of causes or conditions. No thing or event possesses the reality of independence and is, therefore, thoroughly contingent or dependent. The very existence of all phenomena depends upon other factors. It is this absence of independent status that is the meaning behind terms such as emptiness and the emptiness of inherent existence. The Four Noble Truths. If we examine the nature of reality more deeply, we will find that within this complex world, there are things and events that have a certain degree of permanence, at least from the point of view of their continuum. Examples of this include the continuity of consciousness and the mind's essential nature of luminosity and clarity. There is nothing that can threaten the continuity of consciousness or the essential nature of mind. Then there are certain types of experiences and events in the world that appear evident at a particular point but cease to exist after contact with opposing forces. Such phenomena can be understood to be adventitious or circumstantial. It is on the basis of these two categories of phenomena that the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, such as the truths of suffering and its origin, become relevant. When we further examine this dynamic, complex, and diverse world that we experience, we find that phenomena can also be categorized in three ways. 1. The world of matter. 2. The world of consciousness, or subjective experience. 3. The world of abstract entities. First, there is the world of physical reality, which we can experience through our senses, that is, tangible objects that have material properties. Second, there is the category of phenomena that are purely of the nature of subjective experience, such as our perception of the world. As I mentioned earlier, we are often confronted by a gap between the way we perceive things and the way they really are. Sometimes, we know that there is a correspondence. Sometimes, we know there is a disparity. This points towards a subjective quality that all sentient beings possess. This is the world of experience, such as the feeling dimension of pain and pleasure. Third, there are phenomena that are abstract in nature, such as our concept of time, including past, present, and future, and even our concepts of years, months, and days. These and other abstract ideas can be understood only in relation to some concrete reality, such as physical entities. Although they do not enjoy a reality of their own, we still experience and participate in them. In Buddhist texts, then, the taxonomy of reality is often presented under these three broad categories. Out of this complex world of reality that we experience and participate in, how do the Four Noble Truths directly relate to our experiences of pain and pleasure? The basic premise of the Four Noble Truths is recognition of the very fundamental nature we all share, the natural and instinctual desire to attain happiness and overcome suffering. When we refer to suffering here, we do not mean only immediate experiences such as painful sensations. From the Buddhist point of view, even the very physical and mental bases from which these painful experiences arise, the five aggregates, Sanskrit skanda, of form, feeling, discriminative awareness, conditioning factors, and consciousness, are suffering in nature. At a fundamental level, the underlying condition that we all share is also recognized as dukkha, or suffering. What gives rise to these sufferings? What are the causes and conditions that create them? Of the Four Noble Truths, the first two truths, suffering and its origin, relate to the causal process of the suffering that we all naturally wish to avoid. It is only by ensuring that the causes and conditions of suffering are not created, or, if the cause has been created, that the conditions do not become complete, that we can prevent the consequences from ripening. One of the fundamental aspects of the law of causality is that if all the causes and conditions are fully gathered, there is no force in the universe that can prevent their fruition. This is how we can understand the dynamic between suffering and its origin. The last two truths, cessation of suffering and the path to its cessation, relate to the experience of happiness to which we all naturally aspire. Cessation, the total pacification of suffering and its causes, refers to the highest form of happiness, which is neither a feeling nor an experience. The path, the methods and processes by which cessation is attained, is its cause. Therefore, the last two truths relate to the causal process of happiness. The three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. There are two principal origins of suffering: karma and the emotional and mental afflictions that underlie and motivate karmic actions. Karma is rooted in and motivated by mental defilements, or afflictions, which are the primary roots of our suffering and cyclic existence. Therefore, it is important for practitioners to cultivate three understandings. 1. The fundamental nature of consciousness is luminous and pure. 2. Afflictions can be purified, separated from the essential nature of mind. 3. There are powerful antidotes that can be applied to counter the defilements and afflictions. You should develop the recognition of the possibility of a true cessation of suffering on the basis of these three facts. True cessation is what is meant by the jewel of Dharma, the second of the three jewels. Dharma also refers to the path to the cessation of suffering, the direct realization of emptiness. Once you have this deeper understanding of the meaning of Dharma as true cessation of suffering and the wisdom that brings it about, you will also recognize that there are different levels of cessation. The first level of cessation is attained on the path of seeing, when you directly realize emptiness and become an Arya. As you gradually progress through the further levels of purification, you gain higher and higher levels of cessation. Once you have understood Dharma in terms of both cessation and the path, you can recognize the possibility of Sangha, the practitioners who embody these qualities. And once you have understood the possibility of Sangha, you can also envision the possibility of someone who has perfected all the qualities of Dharma. Such a person is a Buddha, a fully enlightened being. In this way, you will be able to gain a deeper understanding of the meaning of the three jewels, the jewel of Buddha, the jewel of Dharma, and the jewel of Sangha. Furthermore, you will recognize the possibility of attaining this state of perfection yourself, and a deep yearning or aspiration to do so will arise in you. Thus, you will be able to cultivate faith in the three jewels. Faith that is not simply admiration, but something that arises from a deep understanding of the teachings of the Four Noble Truths and the Two Truths, and enable you to emulate the states of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. In terms of an individual practitioner's sequence of realization, first and foremost is the jewel of Dharma. When you actualize Dharma within yourself, you become Sangha, an Arya being. As you develop your realization of Dharma, you reach higher and higher levels of the path, culminating in the attainment of the full enlightenment or Buddhahood. Dharma is the true refuge. Sangha comes next, and finally Buddha. In the historical context, Buddha came first because Shakyamuni Buddha came into being as an emanation body, Sanskrit Nirmanakaya, and then turned the wheel of Dharma by giving the scriptural teachings. By practicing the Buddha's teachings, some of his disciples realized the Dharma and became Sangha. Although historically, Dharma comes second in terms of an individual sequence of realization, it comes first. Lama Tsongkhapa's Lines of Experience. This text, which is also known as the abbreviated points of the stages of the path to enlightenment, is the shortest of Lama Tsongkhapa's Lamrim commentaries expounding the teachings of Atisha's lamp. The style and structure of the genre of teachings known as Lamrim, which can be translated as stages of the path, or graded course to enlightenment, follow the arrangement of Atisha's lamp, and the way they are set up allows any individual, regardless of his or her level of realization, to put into practice the appropriate teachings. All the steps of the meditation practices are arranged in a logical, sequential way, so that the practitioner can traverse the path step by step, knowing what to practice now and what to practice next. The reason that this text is sometimes called Songs of Experience is because Lama Tsongkhapa has distilled all his experience and understanding of the Lamrim teachings into these verses and expressed them in the style of a spontaneous song of spiritual realization. The term Lamrim has great significance and suggests the importance of the following 3 points. 1. The practitioner has correct recognition and understanding of the nature of the path in which he or she is engaged. 2. All the key elements of the path and practices are complete. 3. The practitioner engages in all the elements of the practices in the correct sequence. With respect to the first point, the need for correct understanding of the nature of the path, let us take the example of bodhicitta, the altruistic intention. If you understand the altruistic intention to mean solely the aspiration to bring about the welfare of other sentient beings, your understanding of this particular aspect of the path is incomplete and inadequate. True bodhicitta is a non-simulated, spontaneous and natural experience of this altruistic intention. This is how you may mistake a mere intellectual understanding of bodhicitta for a true realization. It is therefore very important to be able to identify the nature of specific aspects of the path. The second point, that all the key elements of the path should be complete, is also critical. As I mentioned before, much of the suffering we experience arises from our complex psychological afflictions. These emotional and mental afflictions are so diverse that we need a wide diversity of antidotes. Although it is theoretically possible for a single antidote to counteract all our afflictions, in reality, it is very difficult to find such a panacea. Therefore, we need to cultivate a number of specific antidotes that relate to specific types of afflictions. If, for example, people are building a very complex structure such as a spacecraft, they need to assemble an enormous variety of machines and other equipment. In the mental and experiential world, we need an even greater diversity of means. With respect to afflictions of the mind and flawed ways of perceiving and relating to the world, Buddhist texts speak of 4 principal false views. 1. The false view of perceiving impermanent phenomena as permanent. 2. The false view of perceiving events, our own existence and the various aggregates, as desirable when they are not. 3. The false view of perceiving suffering experiences as happiness. 4. The false view of perceiving our own existence and the world as self-existent and independent, when they are utterly devoid of self-existence and independence. In order to counteract these false views, we need to cultivate all the various elements of the path. This is why there is a need for completeness. The third point is that we're not just accumulating material things and collecting them in a room. We're trying to transform our mind. The stages of this transformation must evolve in the right order. First, we subdue gross negative emotions, then the subtle ones. There's a natural sequence to Dharma practice. When we cultivate a path such as bodhicitta, gross levels of understanding, such as the simulated, deliberately cultivated ones, arise sooner than spontaneous, genuine experiences and realizations. Similarly, we need to cultivate the practices for attaining higher rebirths and other favorable conditions of existence before cultivating those for attaining enlightenment. These 3 points, correct understanding of the nature of the path, its completeness, and practicing its various elements in the right sequence, are all suggested in the term Lamrim. The origin of the Lamrim teachings, the greatness of the authors. A great number of commentaries came into being on the basis of Atisha's root text, A Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment. Among these is the genre of writings by the Kadampa masters known as Tenrim, or Presentation of the Stages of the Path, as well as Lama Tsongkhapa's Lamrim works. These teachings present different skillful means for teaching the Dharma, but they are all grounded in the writings of authentic Indian masters. In the texts of some of the early Indian masters, we find what is known as the five methods of teaching, or the five aspects of the skillful means of teaching. Later, at Nalanda Monastic University, a unique tradition of presenting the Dharma to students developed. The skillful means of the three purifications, or the three pure factors. 1. Ensuring that the teaching being given is pure. 2. Ensuring that the teacher giving the teaching is pure. 3. Ensuring that the students receiving the teaching are pure. With respect to the second pure factor, even though the teaching being given may be pure, if the teacher giving it lacks the necessary qualities and qualifications, there will be shortcomings in the presentation. It thus became a tradition that before teaching the Dharma, teachers had to receive permission to do so from their own masters. With respect to the third pure factor, even though the teaching and the teacher may be pure, if the students' minds are not properly prepared, then even an authentic teaching may not bestow much benefit. Therefore, the third pure factor means to ensure that the motivation of the listeners is pure. Later on, when the Buddha Dharma underwent a period of decline in the Nalanda area, it began to flourish in Bengal, particularly at Vikramashila Monastery, where a new tradition in the style of teaching emerged. Here, it became customary to begin a teaching by talking about the greatness of the person who composed the text, the greatness and quality of the teaching itself, and the procedure by which the teaching and the listening of that teaching would take place, before moving on to the fourth skillful means, teaching the actual procedure for guiding the disciple along the path to enlightenment. In those days, the majority of the people sustaining and developing the Dharma in the land of the noble beings, ancient India, were monastics, most notably monks from monasteries like Nalanda and Vikramashila. If you look at the masters of these great centers of learning, you will understand how they upheld the Buddha Dharma. They were not only practitioners of the Bodhisattvayana, having taken Bodhisattva vows, but also practitioners of the Vajrayana. Nevertheless, the daily life of all these practitioners was very much grounded in the teachings of the Vinaya, the teachings on monastic ethics. The Vinaya teachings of the Buddha were the actual foundation upon which these monasteries were established and maintained. Two stories illustrate how seriously these great institutions took their monastic discipline. The great Yogacara thinker and highly realized master Dharmapala, who became the main source of the great inspirational teachings of the Sakya Lamdre, Path and Fruition teachings, was a monk at Nalanda Monastery. In addition to being a monk, he was also a great practitioner of Vajrayana, and later became known as the Mahasiddha Virupa. One day, while the disciplinarian of the monastery was on his rounds, he looked into Dharmapala's room and saw that it was full of women. In fact, this great mystic tantric master was emanating dakinis. But since monks were not allowed to have women in their room, Dharmapala was expelled from the monastery. It didn't matter that his infraction was a display of high levels of tantric realization. The fact remained that Dharmapala had broken the codes of monastic discipline and had to go. There is a similar story about the great Indian master Nagarjuna, founder of the Middle Way school, whom all Mahayana Buddhists revere. At one time, the entire Nalanda area was experiencing a terrible drought, and everybody was starving. Through alchemy, Nagarjuna is said to have transformed base metals into gold to help alleviate the famine, which had also affected the monastery. However, the practice of alchemy was a breach of the monastic code, and Nagarjuna too was expelled from the monastery. Lines of Experience, Verse 1. I prostrate before you, Buddha, head of the Shakya clan. Your enlightened body is born out of tens of millions of positive virtues and perfect accomplishments. Your enlightened speech grants the wishes of limitless beings. Your enlightened mind sees all knowables as they are. As we have seen, it is traditional first to present the greatness of the author in order to explain the validity and authenticity of the teaching and its lineage. Therefore, the first verse of Lama Tsongkhapa's Lines of Experience is a salutation to the Buddha. There is a Tibetan saying that just as a pure stream of water must have its source in pure mountain snow, an authentic teaching of the Dharma must have its origin in the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha. That is why there is such emphasis placed on the lineage of the teachings. In this verse, then, the author reflects upon the qualities of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind. The qualities of Buddha's body are presented from the point of view of the perfection of the causes that have created it. The qualities of the Buddha's speech are presented from the point of view of the perfect fruits of his speech, the fulfillment of the wishes of all sentient beings. The qualities of the Buddha's enlightened mind are presented from the point of view of its nature and attributes. In this way, Lama Tsongkhapa pays homage to Shakyamuni Buddha, who was born into the Shakya family and is chief among all humans. When he writes, "I prostrate before you," he is saying, "I bow and touch my head to the lowest part of your body." One of the reasons for stating the causes and qualities of the Buddha's body is to suggest that the Buddha's enlightened body has not existed since beginningless time. It was not there right from the start, but has been created and acquired. The Buddha's enlightened body did not come into being without cause. It was attained through causes and conditions that are compatible with the actual enlightened state. A detailed explanation of the causal relationship between the various practices and the Buddha's enlightened embodiments can be found in Nagarjuna's Precious Garland, Ratnavali. The second sentence describes the quality of the Buddha's enlightened speech as fulfilling the wishes of limitless sentient beings. This explains the actual purpose of attaining enlightenment, which is to benefit other sentient beings. When we become fully enlightened, it is our duty to serve all sentient beings and fulfill their wishes. There are countless ways in which enlightened beings serve sentient beings, such as using their enlightened minds to discern the tremendous diversity of sentient beings' needs and to display miraculous powers. But the primary medium used by fully enlightened beings to fulfill the wishes of sentient beings is their enlightened speech. The term limitless beings suggests that the Buddha uses his enlightened speech in limitless skillful ways. We also find this respect for the diversity of practitioners' mental dispositions in the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha. For example, in acknowledgement of the multiplicity of practitioners' motives, courage, and ethical commitment, we find the three vehicles: the hearer vehicle, Shravakayana, the solitary Buddha vehicle, Pratyekabuddhayana, and the Bodhisattva vehicle, Mahayana. Then, From the point of view of the wide range of philosophical inclinations, we find the Buddhist teachings on the four main schools: Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, Chittamatra, mind only, and Madhyamaka, or middle way. According to the Mahayana scriptures, we can understand the teachings of the Buddha in terms of what are known as the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. The first turning of the wheel was at Sarnath, near Varanasi, and was the first public sermon that the Buddha gave. The main subject of this teaching was the Four Noble Truths, in which the Buddha laid the basic framework of the entire Buddha Dharma and the path to enlightenment. The second turning of the wheel of Dharma was at Vulture Peak, near Rajgir, in present-day Bihar. The main teachings presented here were those on the perfection of wisdom. In these sutras, the Buddha elaborated on the third noble truth, the truth of cessation. The perfection of wisdom teachings are critical to fully understanding the Buddha's teachings on the truth of cessation, particularly to fully recognizing the basic purity of mind and the possibility of cleansing it of all pollutants. The explicit subject matter of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, Prajnaparamita, is the doctrine of emptiness. Then, as the basis for the emptiness teachings, these sutras present the entire path in what is known as the hidden or concealed subject matter of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, which is elaborated in a very clear and systematic way in Maitreya's Ornament of Clear Realization, Abhisamayalamkara. The third turning of the wheel is a collection of sutras taught in different times and places. The principal sutras in this category of teachings are the source material for Maitreya's Uttara Tantra. Not only do they present emptiness, as taught in the second turning of the wheel, but they also present the quality of the subjective experience. Although these sutras do not talk about the subjective experience in terms of the subtleties of levels, they do present the subjective quality of wisdom and the levels through which one can enhance it, and are known as the Tathagatagarbha essence or nucleus of Buddhahood sutras. Among Nagarjuna's writings, there is a collection of hymns along with a collection of what could be called an analytic corpus, such as his Fundamentals of the Middle Way. The analytic corpus deals directly with the teachings on emptiness as taught in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, whereas the hymns relate more to the Tathagatagarbha Sutras. The last line in this verse, "Your enlightened mind sees all knowables as they are," presents the quality of the Buddha's enlightened mind. The reference to all knowables refers to the entire expanse of reality, which encompasses both conventional and ultimate levels. The ability to directly realize both levels of reality within a single instant of thought is said to be the mark of an enlightened mind. This ability is a consequence of the individual having overcome and cleansed not only the afflictions of thought and emotion, but also the subtle traces and propensities of these afflictions. Lines of Experience, Verse 2. "I prostrate before you, Maitreya and Manjushri, supreme spiritual children of this peerless teacher. Assuming responsibility to further all Buddha's enlightened deeds, you sport emanations to countless worlds." In this verse, the author makes salutations to Maitreya and Manjushri and states that they are the two principal disciples of Shakyamuni Buddha. According to the Mahayana scriptures, when the Buddha taught the Mahayana sutras, Maitreya and Manjushri were the principal disciples present. In the Mahayana tradition, we list eight main bodhisattva disciples of Shakyamuni Buddha. However, We should not understand these bodhisattvas as having a physical presence at the Buddha's teachings, but rather as being present on a subtler level of reality. The significance of singling out Maitreya and Manjushri is that Maitreya is regarded as the custodian and medium of the Buddha's teachings on skillful means, and Manjushri is regarded as the custodian and medium of the Buddha's teachings on the profound view of emptiness. Lines of Experience, Verse 3. I prostrate before your feet, Nagarjuna and Asanga, ornaments of our southern continent. Highly famed throughout the three realms, you have commented on the most difficult to fathom, Mother of the Buddhas, perfection of wisdom sutras, according to exactly what was intended. In this verse, the author makes salutations to Nagarjuna and Asanga, who became the custodians and progenitors of the two aspects of the Buddha's teaching. Asanga was the progenitor of the path of skillful means, and Nagarjuna was the progenitor of the path of the profound view of emptiness. Lama Tsongkhapa pays homage to these Indian masters as great revitalizers of the Buddha's teachings. Historically, Nagarjuna came to earth around 400 years after the death of the Buddha, and Asanga about 200 years after the death of Nagarjuna. In light of this distance of time between them, the question immediately arises as to the continuum or lineage between the Buddha and Nagarjuna and Asanga. We can understand the continuity of the teachings through successive living masters in human form, such as the lineage of the transmission of the Vinaya teachings of ethical discipline. But the transmission of the lineage can also be understood on a more subtle level. For example, the celestial form of the Bodhisattva Manjushri had a special connection with Nagarjuna, and Maitreya had a special connection with the Sangha. Thus, the great bodhisattvas may sometimes directly inspire the lineage. When we look at the transmission of the Buddha's teachings in this way, it obviously raises questions about the status of the historical Buddha. In the Buddhist tradition, there are generally two perspectives on this. One views Shakyamuni Buddha in conventional terms. At the initial stage, he is seen as an ordinary being who, through meditation and practice, attained enlightenment in that very lifetime under the Bodhi tree. From this point of view, the instant before his enlightenment, the Buddha was an unenlightened being. The other perspective, which is presented in Maitreya's Uttara Tantra, considers the 12 major deeds of the Buddha as actions of a fully enlightened being, and the historical Buddha is seen as an emanation body. This Nirmanakaya, or Buddha body of perfect emanation, must have its source in the subtler level of embodiment that is called the Sambhogakaya, the Buddha body of perfect resource. These form bodies, Rupakaya, are embodiments of the Buddha that arise from an ultimate level of reality, or Dharmakaya. For this wisdom body to arise, however, there must be an underlying reality, which is the natural purity that I referred to before. Therefore, we also speak about the natural Buddha body, Svabhavikakaya. In the Mahayana teachings, we understand Buddhahood in terms of the embodiment of these four kayas, or enlightened bodies of the Buddha. Maitreya makes the point that while immutably abiding in the expanse of Dharmakaya, the Buddha assumes diverse manifestations. Therefore, all the subsequent deeds of the Buddha, such as becoming conceived in his mother's womb, taking birth, and so forth, are each said to be deeds of an enlightened being. It is in this way that we can understand the connection between the lineage masters of the Mahayana Sutras. Due to the complexity of this evolution, questions have been raised as to the authenticity of the Mahayana Sutras. In fact, similar questions arose even in Nagarjuna's time. In his Precious Garland, there is a section where he presents various arguments for the validity of the Mahayana scriptures as authentic sutras of the Buddha. Similarly, in Maitreya's Ornament of the Mahayana Sutras, Mahayana Sutra Lamkara, there is a section that validates the Mahayana scriptures as authentic sutras. Subsequent Mahayana masters have also written validations of the Mahayana scriptures. One of the grounds upon which the authenticity of the Mahayana sutras has been disputed is the historical fact that when the Buddha's scriptural discourses were originally collected and compiled, they did not include any Mahayana sutras. This suggests that Mahayana scriptures such as the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras were not taught by the Buddha in a conventional public context, but were taught to a select group of practitioners at a higher and purer level of reality. Furthermore, although there are a few cases where the Buddha taught Tantra while retaining his appearance as a fully ordained monk, he taught many of the Tantras by assuming the identity of the principal deity of the mandala, such as Guhyasamaja, when teaching the Guhyasamaja Tantra. There is no reason, therefore, why these Tantras had to have been taught during the time of the historical Buddha. To understand many of these issues from a Mahayana point of view, it is important to understand Buddhahood in terms of the embodiment of the four Kayas. Lama Tsongkhapa, for example, was born 300 years after the death of the great Atisha. Once, when Lama Tsongkhapa was at Rechring, the monastery of Atisha's most famous disciple, Drum Tonpa, he engaged in the deep study and practice of Atisha's lamp for the path. According to his biography, during this period he had vivid encounters with Atisha and Atisha's two principal disciples, as if face to face. This didn't happen just once or twice, but several times over a period of months. During this time, Lama Tsongkhapa spontaneously wrote the verses for the lineage masters of the Lamrim teachings. It is said that it is possible for individuals who are karmically ready and receptive to have encounters with great beings because, even though their physical bodies may have disappeared, their wisdom embodiment remains. Even in our own lifetime, there have been practitioners who have had deep mystical encounters with masters of the past. Only by understanding the nature of Buddhahood in terms of the four Kayas can we make sense of these complex issues. Lines of Experience, Verse 4. I bow to Dipamkara, Atisha, holder of a treasure of instructions, as seen in your lamp for the path to enlightenment. All the complete, unmistaken points concerning the paths of profound view and vast action, transmitted intact from these two great forerunners, can be included within it. In this verse, Lama Tsongkhapa makes salutations to Atisha Dipamkara Srijana. Atisha was an Indian master from Bengal, which is near present-day Dhaka in Bangladesh. He had many teachers, but the principal among them was Sirlingpa, who came from the island of Sirling, the land of gold. Although there seems to be a place with the same name in the southern part of Thailand, according to Tibetan sources, it took 18 months for Atisha to reach the island by boat from India, which suggests that it was much farther away than Thailand. There seems to be a great deal more evidence for Sirling having been located somewhere in Indonesia, probably around Java, and in fact, some reference to the master Sirlingpa that has been found in that area. Atisha received the instructions on the practice bodhicitta from this master. He then received many teachings on the profound view of emptiness from another master, Rigpai Kuchug, Vidya Kokila, the younger, or Avadhutipa. The general understanding is that until Atisha's time, wisdom and method, or emptiness and skillful means, were transmitted as two distinct lineages, even though the masters practiced them in union. It was Atisha who unified the two, and the profound view and vast practice were transmitted together from then on. From Atisha's principal student and the custodian of his teachings, Drumtompa, there evolved three main lineages of the Kadam order. The first was the Kadam Shungpawa, the Kadampa treatise followers, which was handed down through Drumtompa's disciple, Potoa, and emphasized study of the major Indian treatises. The second was the Kadam Lamrimpa, the Kadampa Lamrim followers, where emphasis was placed on a gradual approach to the path to enlightenment, relying more on middling versions of the treatises rather than the great ones. Then a third lineage evolved, the Kadam Mengakpa, the Kadampa instruction followers, which relied more on actual instruction from the teacher and emphasized the immediate practice of visualization and analytical meditation. Potoa's principal student was Sharawa, a very famous master, highly respected for his learning of the great treatises. One of Sharawa's contemporaries was Patsab Lotsawa, the great translator of Chandrakirti's texts from Sanskrit into Tibetan. It seems that before Patsab Lotsawa's time, Chandrakirti's works were not available in the Tibetan language. In fact, when Atisha taught Madhyamaka in Tibet, he used mainly Bhava Viveka's texts, such as The Heart of the Middle Way, Madhyamaka Hridaya, and Blaze of Reasoning, Tarkajvala. During Sharawa's time, however, Patsab Lotsawa began his translation of Chandrakirti's Supplement to the Middle Way, Madhyamaka Vatara. It is said that when Patsab Lotsawa finished the first draft, he presented the manuscript to Sharawa and asked for his opinion. Although Sharawa did not understand Sanskrit, he made critical annotations in key areas of the text and put forward a number of suggestions and corrections. Later, when Patsab Lotsawa compared Sharawa's comments to the original Sanskrit that he had used for the translation, he discovered that Sharawa had noted the exact areas that needed revision. Patsab Lotsawa was so impressed that he praised Sharawa's tremendous depth of knowledge of Middle Way philosophy. Later, after Sharawa received the revised copy of the Madhyamaka Vatara, he often publicly acknowledged the great contribution made by Patsab Lotsawa in bringing this new literature to Tibet. At one of Sharawa's teaching sessions, a devotee made an offering of a small piece of brown sugar to each member of the audience. It is said that Sharawa picked up a handful, threw it up into the air, and said, "May this offering be to the great Patsab, who made the tremendous contribution of bringing Chandrakirti's works to the Tibetan people." It seems that the Tibetan translators working from Sanskrit sources were tremendously learned and courageous individuals. They were also extremely faithful to the original texts. So much so that even today, modern scholars praise the accuracy of the Tibetan translations. Even though the population of Tibet is fairly small, the teachings of the Buddha have flourished there for almost 1,500 years. And over this time, many highly learned Tibetan masters have composed spiritual texts, not just monks, but lay practitioners as well. There is a commentary on the 100,000 verses of the Perfection of Wisdom in the Tengyur, the canon containing all the translated Indian treatises. When Lama Tsongkhapa scrutinized this text, he found so many Tibetan expressions and peculiarly Tibetan ways of saying things that he concluded that it was not an Indian treatise, but an original Tibetan work. He then found corroboration of his conclusion in a catalog, which listed this text as having been composed by the 8th century Tibetan monarch, Trisong Detsen.